The Comics in the Golden Age podcast is a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. For more information, visit comicspodcasts.com.
It was 1938. While war clouds loom throughout Asia and German aggression builds in Europe, Americans seek comfort and distraction. It was to become the golden age of the American comic book.
Life is like a candy cane here in Duckburg. Snowflakes present Santa's sleigh. It's a Duckler. Might make bells jingle or trap Kris Kringle. DuckTales. Christmas Eve, we're out there making DuckTales. Tales of Christmas past and Yuletide DuckTales.
Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Comics in the Golden Age podcast. This is Chris.
And this is Mike.
And this week, we just in time for Christmas, we'll be discussing a Donald Duck story, A Christmas for Shacktown, originally from Four Color, number 367, from January 1952. Please enjoy.
Before we turn to the main story, I want to speak a little bit about Carl Barks. In one of our earliest episodes, I already kind of went off on my love for Carl Barks and his work, so I want to go down that road again all over, but I do want to give a brief comment about his history, and I'm going to read from a bio that was written in the Fantagraphics collection, the Carl Barks Library, and in every issue in the back, Donald Ault wrote a nice little bio section of Carl Barks, so I'm just going to lift from that a little. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but I'm just going to read a few excerpts, just for anyone who may not be familiar with Carl Barks. Barks was born in 1901 and mostly raised in Merrill, Oregon. He had always wanted to be a cartoonist, but everything that happened to him in his early years seemed to stand in his way. He suffered a significant hearing loss after a bout with the measles. His mother died. He had to leave school after the eighth grade. His father suffered a mental breakdown. His older brother was whisked off to World War I. His first marriage in 1921 was to a woman who was unsympathetic to his dreams and who ultimately bore two children, quote-unquote, by accident, as Barks phrased it. The two divorced in 1930. In 1931, he pulled up stakes from Merrill and headed to Minnesota, leaving his mother-in-law, whom he trusted more with his wife, in charge of his children. Arriving in Minneapolis, he went to work for the Calgary Eye-Opener, which is a somewhat risque magazine. He thought he would finally be drawing cartoons full-time, but the editor and most of the staffs were alcoholics, so Barks ended up running the whole show. In 1935, he took a great gamble, and on the strength of some cartoons he'd submitted in response to an advertisement from the Disney studio, he moved to California and entered an animation trial period. He was soon promoted to storyman in Disney's Donald Duck Animation Unit, where he made significant contributions to 36 Donald Duck shorts between 1936 and 1942, including helping to create Huey, Dewey, and Louie for Donald's nephews in 1938. Ultimately, though, he grew dissatisfied. The production of animated cartoons by committee, as he described it, stifled his imagination. For that and other reasons, in 1942, he left Disney to run a chicken farm. When he was offered a chance by Western Publishing to write and illustrate a new series of Donald Duck comic book stories, he jumped at it. The comic book format suited him, and the quality of his work persuaded the editors to grant him a freedom and autonomy he'd never known and that few others were ever granted. He would go on to write and draw more than 6,000 pages in over 500 stories and uncounted hundreds of covers between 1942 and 1966 for Western's Dell and Gold Key imprints. Barks had almost no formal art training. He taught himself how to draw by imitating his early favorites, like Winsor McCay, Frederick Opper, Elsie Sagar, Popeye fame, and Floyd Gottfredson of the early Mickey Mouse newspaper strips. He taught himself how to write well by going to the grammar books he had shunned in school, making up jingles and rhymes, and inventing other linguistic exercises to get a natural feel for the rhythm and dialogue of sequential narrative. Barks married again in 1938, but that union ended disastrously in divorce in 1951. In 1954, Barks married Margaret Winifred Williams, who soon began assisting him by lettering and inking backgrounds in his comic book work. They remained happily married together until her death in 1993. Because Western's policy was to keep the writers and artists anonymous, readers never knew the name of the good duck artist. But they could spot the superiority of his work. When fans determined to solve the mystery of his anonymity finally tracked him down, not unlike an adventure Huey, Dewey, and Louie might embark on, Barks was quite happy to correspond and otherwise communicate with his legion of aficionados. Given all the obstacles of his early years and the dark days that haunted him on and off for the rest of his life, it's remarkable that he laughed so easily and loved to make others laugh. In the process of expanding Donald Duck's characters far beyond the hot-tempered Donald of animation, Barks created a movable locale, Duckburg, and a cast of dynamic characters, Scrooge McDuck, the Beagle Boys, Gladstone Gander, Gyro Gearloose, the Junior Woodchucks. And there were hundreds of others who made only one memorable appearance in the engaging, imaginative, and unpredictable comedy adventures that he wrote and drew from scratch for nearly a quarter of a century. As Roy Disney said on Bark's passing in 2000 at the age of 99, he challenged our imaginations and took us on some of the greatest adventures we have ever known. His prolific comic book creations entertained many generations of devoted fans and influenced countless artists over the years. His timeless tales will stand as a legacy to his originality and brilliant artistic vision.
All right, so moving on to the story, Christmas for Shacktown. The nephews are on their way home and pass through Shacktown, an impoverished area of Duckburg. Seeing the state of the inhabitants, living in squalor, dressed in rags with little food and no money, the nephews become depressed and want to find a way to help. They run into Daisy, who offers to help, getting the assistance of her ladies' club. The nephews decide they can get the Junior Woodchucks to help raise money as well. After all is said and done, they are still short $50, so Daisy convinces Donald to ask Uncle Scrooge, as Donald himself only has $5 to his name to buy his presents. Uncle Scrooge is busy cramming all of his money, 3 square acres worth, back into the bin. And when there is a knock at the door, he tells the visitor to enter as he mans a cannon aimed at the door. Seeing that it's Donald, he backs down, but is miffed that Donald would ask him to give his money away, something Donald knew would happen. Scrooge finally agrees that if Donald can raise half the money, he'll match it. Donald discovers it's hard to get strangers to give money during the holidays, as everyone seems to be in need one way or another around this time. He tries dressing as a distant relative of Scrooge's to borrow the cash, but Scrooge remembers the relative still owes him money from long ago. Donald lets the nephew's pet rat out in the vault and tells Scrooge that he'll catch it as long as Scrooge is willing to pay, but the rat ends up eating the cash once it ends up in Donald's pocket. Donald even tries panhandling, but only makes a dime. When Scrooge sees this, he bumps Donald from his spot and tries panhandling himself. Donald finally tries asking the help of his cousin, Gladstone Gander, who is unfathomably lucky in his everyday life. They walk under windows hoping to catch some falling money in Gladstone's hat, but all that comes down is one burning hot dime, which burns right through the hat. As Gladstone digs for the dime, he finds a wallet full of cash, the owner of which ends up giving a hefty reward, enough to get Donald his money. Donald takes the dime that was thrown at Gladstone and visits Scrooge, who is still panhandling. He drops the dime in the hat, at which point Scrooge decides he's had enough and returns to the vault. He tosses the dime in, but the weight is too much and the bottom falls out of the vault. Donald visits to get the other half of the cash, but Scrooge tells him he's too late, that the money is all gone down a deep pit. Surveyors check the pit out and discover how far down the money has fallen. Not only is it nigh unreachable, it's sitting on a thin layer of bedrock that could easily collapse into a well of quicksand. Donald tells Daisy and the nephews the bad news, and while Daisy settles on the fact that they'll only be able to provide food for Shacktown, not the presents that she had promised, the nephews come up with an idea. They remember there being a cave outside of Shacktown that led beneath Duckburg. They lead Donald and Scrooge into the cave and find the wall of rock behind which the money sits. The nephews rush out and get their tiny toy train set and bring it back. They figure out that they can run the train into the cavern with the cash and call it back out, bringing the money in small batches until it's all out. Scrooge is so excited, he tells the boys they can have the first load of cash for their charity. The plan works, but the first batch is a stack of $1,000 bills. Scrooge faints. The boys, Daisy and Donald, are able to throw an amazing Christmas for the people of Shacktown, with presents and food and decorations. Afterwards, Donald visits Scrooge, who is still in the cave. Scrooge says that while the plan is a success, it'll take him 272 years, 11 months, 3 weeks, and 4 days to get all the money out. In the last panel, the train comes back out with another small batch, with a little toot-toot as Donald and Scrooge plug their ears.
I love this story. One thing is it's really two stories combined. You have the very traditional Christmas tale of trying to raise money for the poor children. Mm. You know, the spirit of Christmas all there. But it's a very traditional vibe to it. But you also have the story of Scrooge potentially losing his fortune, which is also a very traditional Duckburg tale. I mean, that happened a lot back then.
Yes.
He always get it back in the end, but it happened a lot. But he somehow merges these two kind of, I don't want to use the word cliche because it's got a negative connotation, but two, again, traditional stories into one that feels very original overall. Mm. And I like that there's a lot here that kind of represents what made his story so appealing. And one of my favorite parts is how much of a jerk Scrooge is. Mm-hmm. But somehow he still remains a really likable character. I mean, he's the richest man in fiction, and he still is being an ass about giving these poor kids just $25 to help, you know, experience Christmas. And then he becomes such a jerk when he thinks he's lost his money and is mooching off of Donald and the other kids. But somehow you still love his character throughout the whole storyline. And, you know, Huey and Dewey and Louie, they're quite likable. And, of course, as usual, they're the ones to save the day in the end by getting his money back with their toy train. And I love the art. His art, he uses so few lines, but makes the character so expressive. The looks of exasperation or panic on Donald's face or frustration with Scrooge, the sheer anger Scrooge has, like, through most of the panels he's in, the detail of Shacktown and the poor kids. Mm-hmm. It's funny because he manages to make them get across the tragedy of their existence, but still make the whole scene, I don't know if cute's the right word, but it still is very charming, you know. It's got a very Christmas Carol kind of vibe to it, with the way their shanty town looks and their patches on their clothes, their old torn clothes, stuff like that. The cute faces. It's just a very charming kind of story, and I just really enjoyed it.
It's interesting what do you say about the style of the art? It's interesting to me, like, just how consistent it is with the rest of the depiction of Duckburg, because one of the things that was really intriguing to me about this story was this was an area of Duckburg that I did not realize existed. That through the DuckTales cartoons and through the other stories, that they seem to depict the upper and middle and some of the lower class people from Duckburg, or characters from Duckburg, but this was an area that I didn't really consider being a part of Duckburg, and in part because, like you said, the richest character in all of fiction lives in this town. So, yeah, it's, and the way that he did it, that it's that very clean, few lines, like the way that he approached it, the art is all very consistent, and it looks like that sort of Disney house style. But it's depicting these characters that, like you said, they have patches on their clothes. They're living in shacks, and, you know, it's interesting to see that he was able to be consistent with the artwork and not go overboard, I guess, with the depiction of these characters.
Yeah, when I first became familiar with the Donald Duck comics by Barks through Gemstone, it was years and years before I really ever got exposed to any other Dell comics, mm-hmm. in particular Disney comics. Now in the 2000s, I've gone back and I've picked up a lot. And I like a lot of them, you know, other Disney ones. But once you see the others, you can really understand why fans used to call him the good duck artist.
Right.
Because he does have... There is a clear difference between his art and what you would see in the typical. Not that they're bad. Again, I enjoy a lot of them. Mm-hmm. But his tend to have a more... Oh, not just the art, but the actual storylines tend to have a more... Some of them are epic with the real adventure ones, the sort of Indiana Jones-like adventures. Some are more charming like this, but they all are just have a little higher quality to them than what you see in the other comics. Mm-hmm. And so you do get an understanding once you start seeing the other work why he was so beloved in comparison to why he's... And really, if you think about it, Dell Comics is really... I mean, they were so huge in the 50s and 60s. They adapted everything from Donald Duck to all the Mickey Mouse and Disney characters to Tom and Jerry to the Looney Tunes. They adapted television shows like from the Lone Ranger in the 50s and Zorro all the way up to like... I'm trying to think, the Mod Squad in the 60s. And, you know, they've been... Television adaptations were their thing. But so much of what they've done has been lost, except for this huge legacy the Donald Duck comics have birthed through all the continued reprints of Jim Stone and other countries. I mean, sorry, other companies through the cartoon in the 80s and now the new one on TV, which I, not to offend Don Rosa, I know the cartoons are not the same as the comics. He, if you see Don Rosa at convention, he always has this big sign up that says, you know, I draw the comics. I have nothing to do with the TV show. But it's still a legacy. Those are clearly inspired by these original adventures in this world built by Carl Barks. And it's just fascinating to me that with all the work Dell produced for two or three decades, including when they became Gold, when Gold Key kind of took over, that this comic, the Donald Duck books, have had far and away the biggest legacy in mm-hmm. pop culture through mostly those cartoons.
Well, and I think the part of that it has to do with the fact that the Barks's art was, well, as we were saying, it was so consistent, and he makes it, well, he created a number of these characters, but even the ones that he didn't, he made into his character, whereas other artists working on other books are likely drawing from a source material or some sort of worksheet. Like they've got the way that like Tom and Jerry is supposed to look, but they don't know what other characters are supposed to look like, what other animals are supposed to look like in that Tom and Jerry world. So I feel like Carl Barks, you know, felt very confident in what he was doing, what he was creating, and that it showed in his work.
Yeah, I've read that some of the Looney Tunes, the Tom and Jerry, and yeah, they don't ever world build. Mm-hmm. They don't ever fill in with other characters generally. I mean, occasionally some will show up, but they don't create, you know, a world around them of cities and other characters and family histories and stuff to create kind of its own continuity like they did. They're still generally just the characters you would see in the cartoon having adventures very similar to what you would see in the cartoon, whereas he clearly built this whole world beyond what you would see from the Donald Duck cartoons.
Mm-hmm. So while I was doing research for this, I came across the there was a something of a sequel to this, or a follow-up story to this, it was published in 2002. It was a Don Rosa story. It was based on an idea contributed by a Norwegian fan. I'm going to mess up this name, but Sigfeld Grossfield Jr., who runs the Rosa fan site, The Duckman. In the sequel story, it's the story of when Scrooge meets Gyro. And Gyro, after making a lamp Scrooge breaks Donald's lamp, Donald takes the lamp to Gyro to get it fixed. And rather than Gyro just fixing the lamp, he turns the lamp into a sentient lamp. So they He finds out about Scrooge's money having fallen down into this cavern, and that Scrooge is trying to get all the money out by this train and how long it's taking. So he sends the robot or the lamp into the cavern to find out the dimensions of it. So then they decide that they can fill the cavern with helium in order to float everything back up to the surface, which they do, but then not to ruin that story, that causes other problems. But I thought that was nice that, you know, over, what is it, 50 years after the story, then they managed to come up with a nice little follow-up to, because it might be the next story, or I can't remember if it's the next story or the story after, Scrooge's money is all back in the vault. It's like no explanation. It's just, even though he says that it's going to take him over 272 years to get it all out, like, you know, a couple days or weeks or whatever later, it's suddenly all out and, you know, safe and sound back in the vault.
Well, I just assumed that Huey, Dewey, and Louie had come up with some remarkable device to get it out quicker, like they usually do. But I'm not surprised that he did that, because Don Rosa has on a number of occasions done specific sequels to the Karl Barks stories, and he's always been very clear that he views himself as operating in the continuity created by Karl Barks specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, not just Disney's Donald Duck, but specifically Karl Barks. Although he's also been very clear that he doesn't consider his work, this is debatable, I think highly of his work, but he doesn't consider his work to be of the quality of Karl Barks. He views himself, this is me paraphrasing, but I feel like when I hear him describe his work in Divration, he considers his work sort of fan fiction set in that world. Hmm. Is kind of the vibe I get from it. I would definitely give him more credit than that, because he's written some amazing Donald Duck stories, and he's very talented himself. Bit cantankerous in attitude if you read his interviews. But he was... I met Don Rosa twice at a convention, once with my oldest daughter a few years ago, and he was extremely polite and friendly to her and courteous to both of us. I took two volumes of his collection, and the first one we got him to draw Uncle Scrooge. Nice. And the next time we went back, that was when I was alone, but I got him to write it to both her and I. And then the next year I went back with her, and we got him to do one of the nephews, and she was there and watched him draw it. She actually, if anyone listening has kids, my daughter is 12. When she was 7 or 8, I started letting her borrow some of my Fantagraphic books collecting the Karl Barks stories. She loved them. She flew through like 4 or 5 volumes in no time at all. So I do think that these are timeless. And if you have kids around that age, I would definitely recommend, you know, at least giving them the opportunity. Obviously, everyone's different taste, but I think there's definitely a potential there to hook some younger readers on these.
That's I had this book in the car the other day when I picked my 10-year-old up from school, and he jumped in the car and goes, "Oh yeah, I'm just gonna read this." And by the time we got home, he had read almost the entire book. So, yeah.
They really are timeless. You could pick one of these up now and think it was written within the last few years. There's very other, because the cartoon style, sometimes when you see older automobiles and stuff, it fits with the comic. It doesn't stand out. Mm-hmm. And there's really only a tiny number of anachronisms like that. You know, some of the technology, like the phones and stuff, but I think a lot of that stuff would fly by kids just because the setting is so ridiculous in the first place that they wouldn't even notice. You know, they would just, oh, it's a goofy looking phone. So I think it worked.
Well, and I got to say too, I don't mean this to, I'm afraid that this will come across as something negative about Karl Barks' work or Don Rosa's work, but there's something to it that the artwork flows so well that you can just these stories, like the A Christmas for Shackdown, I think is like 30 pages long, but it flies by. Like, you can just,
oh yeah,
you like you don't have to. I don't know. I mean, I read A Christmas for Shacktown, some 30 pages in, you know, it would take me, I don't know how much longer to read, like, whatever, Doomsday Clock or whatever I got recently, because there's so much in every panel that I gotta, like, you know, yeah. I have to pay attention to. This all flows very, very nicely.
And so. It's not for lack of dialogue or writing. There's a lot there. But it's just the pacing and the lighter tone to it is just, it is a speedy read. You do go through it quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always find myself when I read one of the stories, I'll read it and then I'll find myself kind of going back through the pages just to kind of gaze at the art a little and kind of appreciate mm-hmm. some of the panels. But the initial read does move pretty quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's probably one of the reasons I think it is appealing to younger readers like that. You know, they're not making a huge investment of time or anything. It's something you just pick up and, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, they're done with the story.
Yeah. Well, and I wonder, too, I remember seeing these comics when I was, I was probably a little older than my son, right when there was that big, the Image Comics boom. And I remember seeing these comics, and specifically, like, an issue of Tom and Jerry, and, just being really turned off that, you know, oh, I could have this cool, like, this cool Spawn comic instead of, you know, this kitty comic. And I look back on it now, and I'm like, oh, God, this is so much better. I don't know what I was thinking.
You know, you're too cool for school kind of attitude when you're, you know, like a teenager and stuff.
Right.
And it's funny now, these are, like, some of my favorite comics to read. Like, I get super excited when one of the new, like, Fantagraphics collections come out, you know, more than I do most other stuff being produced. It's just, I don't know, maybe we're just old now, but, you know, it's great comics. It's just pure fun.
Yeah, no, I was pretty excited that usually for some of these, we have a pretty good comic selection or a graphic novel selection at the library here in town. And I was happy that this was an instance where they didn't have the book, so I had to actually order it. So now I can have it as part of my permanent collection. So,
also on Carl Barks, I should mention for listeners who may not be aware, throughout the once he'd become kind of introduced to fans and they became aware of who Carl Barks was, he wasn't just the Good Duck artist, they knew him by name. He did start producing a lot of commission work, and he did a lot of paintings, sort of recreating scenes from these old comics throughout the 1970s. And if you go online and look them up, there's some beautiful paintings out there. If you follow our Twitter account, Comics in the GA, usually there's not more than a few weeks go by that I don't post some of them. So you can see them there, but also just look at some online, and they're just a lot of fun, and they're just beautifully detailed paintings. And a good chunk of them, like I said, recreate scenes from the old comics. There's also some holiday theme ones. Apparently, like, they're quite pricey, but it was funny when I was watching with my daughter the Christmas special for the current DuckTales cartoon. There was a scene in a house, and up on the mantle, there was a painting of Uncle Scrooge, and it was a recreation of one of Carl Barks' paintings of Uncle Scrooge that he did, which in itself was based on a panel from an old comic book. So I just got a kick out of that kind of nod to him in the DuckTales Christmas episode. But those paintings, again, check them out if you've never seen them. They're really, really beautiful, and they're just a ton of fun.
All right, so I guess that will do it for this episode of Comics in the Golden Age. You can keep up with us through our Facebook and, like Mike said, over on our Twitter. It's Comics in the GA. That's also our email address. It's comicsinthega@gmail.com. And, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. I guess that's about it. So, thank you all for listening. We'll hopefully have something else for you guys real soon. For tonight, thank you all, and hope you're having a happy holidays. This is Chris.
This is Mike.
Thank you all, and have a great night.
On the 12th day of Christmas, my true love gave to me 12 days of Christmas, 11 planes of flying, 10 days of Christmas, 8 days of Christmas. Oops, forgot the 9th day, 7 samurai, 6 comes after 7.
Lots of Christmas days, 4 Christmas days, 3 Christmas days, 2